Hey, welcome to Divergent Paths with Dan Dunford. Season 2? Question mark? I guess. I don't know. Now that... It's funny, a lot of podcasts are becoming things with season structures now, which seems strange to me. I mean, I get that some of these things, like with Malcolm Gladwell and Serial and a number of... Quite a few now. That research and blah 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 takes time, but season structure and podcasting is still weird to me. Anyway, that's great right off the top. I'm obviously out of practice for recording. My intros are always so good, but obviously I'm coming off of a 2-week hiatus of no podcasts or videos or anything, so that's the crack about season 2. So I hope everyone didn't forget that this existed and will continue listening. Happy fall. Well, I mean, in 2 days, happy fall. Happy fall week. And I hope your, you know, summer ended out quite nicely. Mine was a little weird. Weird in a sort of good way. Spent several days filming with Mozart in the Jungle on Rikers Island, which was very strange. If you want to know more about that, ask me in person, because I have lots of thoughts that no one cares about. Had the pleasure of going up and playing some shows with Pitch Black Brass Band, which obviously is a huge joy for me, because it combines my love of traveling and brass playing and hip-hop. So it was great, and happy that me getting to know them turned into me playing with them. And of course, you can go back and listen to their interview on iTunes. Still one of the best ones I've done, or two of the best, you know, since it was a two-parter. Anyway, this week's guest is Ryan Straber. You may not recognize that name, but Ryan is an incredible recording engineer, and a guy who's recorded, you know, everyone from John Zorn and Steve Reich, some of the titans of contemporary classical music, and as all the way to people, you know, kids recording their or grad school screening audition tapes, pre-screening rather. And he has a studio, about a half hour north of the city. And, I went in to observe him recording some stuff with previous guest, Will Lang. Will was gracious enough to have me come up there and film some of the stuff that he was doing in his recording session for his new album that's coming out soon. And I got to meet Ryan, and man, you know, what a guy. We talk about his background in the interview, but he's a classically trained contemporary composer who just is a phenomenal engineer, and just such a incredibly, I don't know, I was just blown away by just his knowledge of music and recording. We get into it, but I had to, this is one of the more fascinating ones I've done. I mean, I love talking to everyone that I talk to. This was something that I didn't know very much about, and, was really happy to get the chance to talk to him, because, you know, he doesn't have to talk to me. Ryan and, his partner, Jessica Slavin, run Octaven Audio, which is a half hour north of the city. It's a great place. If you need to record something, you should look into it. It's really nice. They're good at what they do. They have just a good operation. I hope you enjoy my talk with Ryan. If you're interested in Octaven, you can check out octavenaudio.com. That's OKTAVENAUDIO.com. Look them up, see if you need some recording done. Hop on over to iTunes or Stitcher and rate and review the podcast. If you're not subscribed and you enjoy the show, hit that subscribe button. And if you have a few extra dollars lying around, hop on over to patreon.com, patreon.com/divergentpathspod. Pledge a dollar a month to keep this going. Later this week, I'm also coming back with more videos. This week will be Seraph Brass, who were on the show a few episodes ago, and I'm looking forward to putting that together and releasing it. So, enjoy the show. Talk to you next week. Fixed it, and I mean, it's fine though. That's okay. Good. We're good.
Okay.
We're good. That was just really strange. Anyway, thanks for doing this before your work day, which sure. I'm sure is nice and
my pleasure.
nice and full of things to do. who do you have coming in today?
Oh, it's just there's a demo kind of like video thing today, which. This isn't the season when that is a big part of our calendar, so it's a little bit of a one-off thing.
What do you mean by
I'm actually not totally. I'll find out when they get here what it's for. It's a violin and piano thing video, and so I presume it's for some kind of competition or grad school application or something of that nature. Like
that seems like a
required.
That seems like a lot of money to spend on a grad school application. If I'm in the position to do that, like, of course, yeah, I'll do it for you, but man.
Different places, although I've done a lot of these types of things, especially for competitions, you see it most frequently with, like, violinists and pianists, but also singers and, it's not just a matter of, like, yes, they need the thing for one application, but they decide that it's good to have the content that they can use for other things. And, you know, if they're recording some standard rep piece, that's something they can potentially be used in other situations and get doing it well.
Just hope you don't get too much better too fast.
Yeah.
That's, you know.
Yeah.
Like if, anyway, but.
this kind of latter half of, or I should say the first half of August and latter half of July, we're a little bit quiet in terms of sessions, and we've just been trying to get through a lot of editing. Since we reopened here in the new studio, we just had this huge backlog of work to get through, work on stuff that had already been recorded in the old studio.
Right.
But when we were in limbo between spaces, I just didn't have any really good setup to work on. So we've been a little bit lighter on actual recording sessions, but really heavy on just like getting through ton of editing, mixing, mastering, and like
the stuff that's not quite as fun.
Right. The stuff that's like I'm sitting alone in this room for 12 hours in front of the computer, but you know, it still obviously is great work and it's exciting, it's just those, you know, I can't deny that I enjoy sessions
you're sitting, you're in here with, I was up here kind of observing, you working with, and it's not just Will, it's his, Jen, who's like, very heavily involved in everything he does, and the producer, and then it's just like, everyone's here, and it's kind of like, while everyone might not be talking necessarily, everyone's kind of here and paying attention to what's going on, and there's interaction and creation and artistic, and there's all that stuff can happen when you're sitting in here by yourself, plugged into a computer, but it's more computer interaction.
yeah exactly. No, definitely. And it's interesting, that's such a big part of the job is doing that solitary work of just like getting through edits and going through revision notes and doing all that stuff. And it's also the thing that, although I obviously like, this room in particular is built to be able to do that work really well. This whole place is really made for recording music. And so it always feels a little bit funny too when I'm sitting alone in this room and that room out there on the other side of the glass is just kind of sitting there dormant. You know, there's a part of me that feels like, oh, we're not using
we're
this
doing
space.
It wrong,
but it's like,
no, of course.
Yeah, it has to be, you know, you can't record a mountain of material and then just, you know, not do something with it, obviously. So,
oh yeah, I guess you could, but
we've actually one thing that's changed a bit in the, you know, since we've set up here and part of the hope of the way this place is designed is that it's more friendly for having extra engineers, mm-hmm. having additional engineers working here doing some editing and like post-production stuff as well. So we have
a secondary room, right?
And we've been much more regularly having in a small roster of guys who have been doing work with me and for me on a lot of different projects. So that's helping to share the burden of that work and make it so that we can take more advantage of this, mm-hmm. you know, the recording room and not have to block out so much time. But it takes, you know, I was so used to running a kind of essentially a one-man operation. It's me and my partner, Jessica.
Right.
And she primarily runs the administrative side of things. So I was the one in the studio.
You're just the guy.
You know, and it, you know, although that can be...
Well, and I'm sure it was... obviously that's fun because you get to work with everyone and from like top to bottom be like, yes, I was here when you put together your instrument the first time in my studio and I will be involved all the way up until I, right. you know, I basically hand you whatever it is that you hand them.
Yeah, right.
Or email them.
Yes.
Right. Email the files that you emailed and you, when you hit send or hand them the thumb drive with the, right. with everything on it. But, you know, and I'm sure that was far more practical in, say, 2012.
Yeah, well, when we first opened the old studio in 2009.
Okay.
Actually, almost exactly a year ago right now. And at that point, I was working as a freelancer. And so, we lived in a little apartment on the Upper West Side. I had a travel rig that I brought around to wherever, you know, it was that we were working. And then I just worked out of a little kind of nook in my apartment on headphones, mostly. And so just moving into a dedicated space already was such a massive change, but my whole mentality was still just like, sole proprietor, so to speak. We were very lucky that the workload continued to get heavier and we took on more and more projects, but I just kind of continued to do it that way. Just like, all right, I guess I'm doing, you know, 80-hour weeks with no vacation for long, long stretches of time. And it's like in a certain way, you get into a mode where you feel, how could I, you know, who am I to complain? I'm, you know, this is so great. But then...
But at the same time, that's Wall Street hours without Wall Street pay.
That's very well put, exactly. And, you know, in a business like this, we put every bit of, you know, I don't want to get talking about... financial stuff, but I mean, you know, the fact is we put everything back into the business, and especially making this move was like, okay, we are, you know, everything that we had, whatever we had been able to save up over the years that we were working in the old studio in Yonkers, we put into here with the hopes that this will be a step a new kind of level of both quality of work and type of work we can do. And so,
and you're not, there's no in a studio like this, well, in a studio the size of this, I mean, obviously, people, if someone's listening, they won't be able to physically see it. But I mean, it's big. Like, you could conceivably not have to leave here, like, unless the business got just a lot, like, really, really big.
Yeah.
You could stay here,
and I think
for the conceivable future.
Yeah, I think that my guess is that at least in the New York area, I don't think there's going to be a time anytime soon when there will be I could be wrong, but in a way I hope I'm wrong, but you know, anyone who's at all involved in the music industry knows that, you know, the studio world in general has shrunk,
mm-hmm.
you know, kind of violently, and in New York in particular, like, just all of the bigger old studios, all the classic places.
They're all gone.
And the few that are still left are struggling, not because they don't have business, but because they're fighting the real estate market, you know, and they're fighting landlords.
just like everyone else. Like,
and they're also fighting, you know, and they're fighting a shrinking music industry as well. But they, but, you know, the story I hear again and again is, you know, we're booked, but, you know, the building's worth more than our business. And, you know, we located ourselves here and went for a size of space like this that to me feels like, okay, this is bigger than most of the other places that are left around for the kind of music that we do, which is, it's a tough place to be because, you know, we're working in a specialty of, you know, kind of classical jazz, experimental, new music stuff where, you know, the profit is not this is not like 90s hair band, you know,
you're not
$1 million records
or or even just like doing you know, just like punching in horn tracks for Maynard Ferguson or anything on those whatever, record labels, like
whatever it may be. And even those, you know, I mean, it's, you know, there's just not the kind of and then, of course, there are good things and bad things about this. I mean, you know, I really like the fact that for the vast majority of artists with whom I work, you know, they're the ones who are in control of what they're doing. Now, you know, of course, that comes with the burden of they're the ones that are paying or raising the money or kind of handling the the reality of making it happen, but it's also theirs. Yeah. You know, they're not, it's very, very rare that a label or an interest outside of the artists themselves really has a kind of final say in what the programming is, what the sound is like, what the, you know, what the album title is, what the artwork on the album is. You know, everything really is so, artist driven in the work that we do. And yeah, you know, inherently it's not, they're small budgets, you know, but I always feel like there's such a core of integrity and of,
well, you know, a lot of time they're basically, in a way, they're saving their pennies to like put something together that they really believe in.
Yeah.
It's not, you know, they're not coming off of, you know, they're not doing the middle record of a 3-record deal with some, with I don't fucking need whatever new music subsidiary of EMI.
Yeah, right.
Whatever their imprint is for that specific.
Yeah, I don't even know. Is there even EMI? I mean, yes.
I know there is.
Yeah, no, I know.
Because one of the trombone players is married to someone who works there.
That's awesome. No, I mean, it's so far. That's in a weird way. That's so distant from my world.
Exactly. Like, even if they do have a new music imprint, it's so many levels down from the parent company that they might not even care anyway.
Right. Right. And I mean, you know, in the stuff that we work on, you know, even when we've done some kind of some bigger things or, you know, things with composers who are much more well-known and established and have a higher profile, or jazz artists who will kind of fit that bill, you know, it's still stuff that's being released through small labels or through, you know, their own labels, or, you know, I worked on an album that was released on Warner Classics last year, but it was like licensed to Warner. They didn't, you know, they only got involved at the very tail end of things because they had some particular specs about how they wanted the master delivered. But it was like, it was nothing like what I presume the traditional structure of having, you know, kind of label representation involved in the production of the record throughout the process. Like, that just doesn't happen in my world.
I mean, I would imagine in some ways, even for like, you know, some of the more prominent guys that you've worked with, like, it would be easier for them to just start their own, like, quote unquote, experimental new music label than it would be for them to try and get something going with a pre-existing label.
Yeah. I think that can sometimes be, you know, a decent option. But, you know, and look, I really don't mean to, it's very easy to make this kind of stereotype of, oh, the big labels and it's bad.
No.
And I don't mean to even imply that I have that if only because I don't have enough direct experience. You know, I'm sure there are amazing people working at you know, at the bigger labels that are struggling to do the best they can given the challenges of the
right.
But music, I mean, buying
a lot of what we're talking about right is now, like, you know? Such a niche,
yeah,
a niche product. Even, you know, New York is flourishing with these types of musicians,
yeah.
But even so, it's still such a small,
and that's actually.
I mean, it's growing, and right. you know, it's not just like two weird guys playing Berio and
right.
Rabe or whoever, like right. in 1975, and like coming out with like the fifth core 15 pieces. Let's just say for trombone,
yeah,
like these core. You know, now it's you can, you know, it might not always be good, but you can just like run down to Columbia or Brooklyn College or whoever and like get a, you know, some, there's going to be some decent composers pumping out like interesting,
yeah,
experimental music. So, you
yeah,
know.
I, you know, and this is kind of getting into a different topic, but mm-hmm. I think it's a really, there's two things that I'd say, that are things I think about and deal with a lot because it's, you know, there's a, I studied composition and I studied composition with, you know, the kind of, you know, most modernist, you know, uptown person that you could come right. up with. And I was really steeped in that world when I was a student. I started with Milton Babbitt.
Okay.
And I cherish the fact that I was wonderful. Mm-hmm. I was studying with him for 5 years and it was amazing working with him. This is in like, you know, I think I studied with him from 1999 or maybe 98 to 2003. Mm. You know, even then the new music world was just in New York at least, and I think more broadly, but certainly in New York, was just a fundamentally different world. And I think the whole, you know, music economy was fundamentally different. And those things go together in very, I think, significant ways, needless to say. But you know, when I started getting into doing recording work, I did it in part through a very modernist kind of idea of what making the recordings was for and what the pieces were for, you know, what the relationship between the composer and the instrumentalist is. And all of these things were really, I felt like, in the context of this idea of the new music world that assumed, for example, that you would almost never have an audience of more than 30 people, and they would always be the same 30 people that you would see at every other concert, because yeah. that's the new music. That was the world I knew.
Right.
You know, go to Merkin, you hear, you know, the same group of players play the same group of composers, and you just, there was almost a safety in the idea that the world was really small.
Yeah.
There was a comfort in that. You didn't expect to make, you know, you didn't expect to have your work seen by or heard by a broader public.
Right. I would, you know, and even like, even if you, I always, this is one of my favorite things to think about is like, if you go back to like 50s and 60s, even like some of the, like the, what's the word I'm looking for? Titans, mm-hmm. Titans of like the early new music, like mid 20th century.
Yeah.
I always think, like bring up the fact like Morton Feldman was still working in a laundromat, like, yeah. Well into when he was like writing good music and hanging out with John Cage and all these guys, like he still had to, he was having his music, he was writing a lot of music and having stuff performed, but he was working in a laundromat.
Yeah. And no, I mean, and the funny thing is that you could say the same thing of a lot of composers now, mm-hmm. and musicians now. I mean, you got to, and this gets to kind of the second half of what I was going to talk about is, you know, along with the new music world changing a lot, I think the burden on composers and performers to exist in a, you know, really harsh reality in New York City, economically, and also do it in a way where they're kind of playing the game of what's expected of a musician in our mm-hmm. much bigger world now. It's still tiny, don't right. get me wrong, but you know, I kind of wonder how people do it in a way. You know, there's so much more that's expected in terms of all the different hats that people wear. I mean, you have to make a living in, you know, in New York, which in itself is really tough, and, you know, be present in so many different ways and be active in so many different ways. And, you know, there's so many people who are active. And it, so it's a very exciting thing that there's so much going on and there's so much variety and, you know, there are so many actors on the scene, so to speak, on the stage. But yeah, at the same time, it's daunting. And I wonder, from what we do here, you know, it's... we want to continue doing better quality work. We built that studio, for the primary reason of wanting to deliver a better experience and better product and make better recordings and have a more fun place to play in and all this stuff. But, you know, what comes with that is it costs a lot to do. And so, you know, we have to, you know, kind of meet the realities of that. Pardon me. And then, you know, when on the other side of it, you're dealing with these musicians who are just, you know, more and more just struggling to kind of keep it going. It's tough. And it feels like, you know, I know there's a, we're doing our best to meet that.
You're right.
And, you know, and to make it, you know, work realistically, but it's hard and it's frustrating to see a city like New York where, you know, it's the only place that you can be. And it's like also the last place you should be. It's, you know, it just, it's always, it feels like a catch 22, but it's somewhat,
you know. Yeah. I mean, you, it's, there's like a never ending cycle of doing things you, even if you're only playing music, like even if you don't have to have an outside job, like there's like an endless cycle of, oh, well, I guess I'm going to do this, which I like, but sort of like, I mean, I'm not saying that people don't like the other things that they do necessarily, but you take a group like Alarm Will Sound or Room Full of Teeth, like these are like the two of the premier groups in the country.
Yeah.
Like they do shows, they do tours, they do all this stuff. But I mean, like a friend of mine who's in Room Full of Teeth, he just took a job as the conductor for San Francisco Conservatory. Like,
which is great. Yeah.
Yeah. Which is awesome. Like, but he couldn't, you know, he was cobbling together a life as a freelance conductor and singer in New York while being part of a Grammy winning ensemble that would occasionally go out to sing with Kanye West. Like,
It's just, that's a great kind of illustration of where we're at. You know, I mean, I hate to sound like when I was, you know, but when I was a composition student and when I thought that I was going to be, you know, a composer for a living, or for the rest of my life, and that was my main goal, you know, the basic assumption was that, well, I mean, of course you'll get a teaching job and you'll go for your DMA or your PhD and you'll get a teaching job at some, you know, some small school somewhere. And that will be the way you make a living, because that's the only way that composers make a living. Like, there just was, it was such a limited idea of what it is that you can do.
Write well enough for long enough until you can ace that interview.
Yeah, get exactly.
Get that degree and ace the interview.
But, you know, it's like, I don't know. And for people who are able to get that kind of a life established for themselves and are able to make it work where they have, you know, the structure in place to support themselves, but also the space and the time to do their artistic work. You know, that's amazing. But it started to become apparent to me, you know, around, I don't know, around 2006, 2007, that I was not up to going back for a DMA, and B, that it just didn't feel like, well, at the very least, I don't want to put any, you know, make any judgments, but it dawned on me that that's not the only way. Now what wound up happening for me is I've, you know, really kind of stopped composing. And that I'm still trying to figure out whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, honestly. Like, it's, you know, I know at the very least it comes from the immediate issue that I spend, you know,
80 hours
almost
a week,
all my working and waking life listening to music. So it's hard to then like go home and want to do something besides like watch RuPaul's Drag Race or something, you know, like, you know, that it no longer feels like my, you know, like the kind of haven that it used to. It feels just more like, oh, now I'm doing more of what I've been doing all day, except it's the burden's on me to make it interesting.
And I guess in some ways, like, I mean, this probably will sound a little cheesy or trite, but I mean, I wouldn't say you're composing using other people's things, basically. Well, in some ways, process-wise.
I would put it slightly differently. I think that, I don't think of the work that I do here as an engineer as composing per se, but it definitely does feel like I'm, you know, serving the kind of goal of I've actually never thought of how to verbalize this precisely, but I think, you know, I like the fact that, unlike when you're a composer and you write a piece, and the way I was trained and kind of thought of my role as a composer was that it's incumbent upon me to put down every last detail I possibly can and, you know, clarify my intentions on the page so that, you know, then musician X, Y, Z, whoever plays the piece can pick up that document and render it in mm-hmm. this way that realizes my intentions. And that's a very, you know, what I love about the work I do here is the relationships are much more fluid when you're actually involved in, like, making music happen and trying to make it as good as it can be. You know, there's a lot of back and forth. There's a lot of collaboration when the composer is involved in the session, especially. that is, I think those sessions are most gratifying and productive when you feel like there's some give and take and it doesn't feel like this is the composition and it must be played exactly as it's written, otherwise it's a failure. Like, no, I think it's what's exciting about this is seeing the ways in which, you know, on a given day with a given performer and a given score, you know, certain deviations from the score or certain, you know, taking what's in the score and trying to push it further or doing things like that makes for a more exciting musical experience. And that's stuff that I've learned so much watching that happen. And it's the kind of stuff that you just, you know, you can't really know or have an idea of when you're just sitting at a desk and,
right,
you know, in distance from actual music making. And this is kind of, I'm stating the obvious in a way, but at the same time, I know that when I was a younger composer, I really just had such a disconnect from, you know, from actual instrumental and vocal, for that matter, you know, music making, like the physicality of it.
I don't know. The music community, like so many things that in retrospect seem super obvious, mm-hmm. in the middle of it, maybe not so obvious.
Yeah.
So you finished up your compositional studies, so yep. to speak, in what, you said 2003?
2003, I finished my master's.
Yeah. Finished your master's, okay. Yeah. You went to Juilliard,
yeah.
right? Okay. So, you know, but that's a 6-year gap between finishing up your studies with one of the greats of late, you know, mid to late 20th century American music, mm-hmm. and you know, anyone. Well, I mean, studying with specific, or I mean, there's something about, you know, if you're an instrumentalist, right, you study with a great teacher. That's can be prestigious in some ways, but it's so dependent because, like, it's so different, so different. You know, I studied with David Taylor, mm-hmm. which, you know, provides me with a certain, like I get put in a kind of a certain box, a box of no boxes, ideally. But right. you know, like, just I'm a weird dude who does a lot of different stuff, mm-hmm. like my teacher did. Composition, like studying with specific composers, I mean, that's a lot. Since they accept fewer people generally, mm-hmm. it's a lot more personalized. With, oh, who did you study with?
Right.
I mean, and correct me at any point if I'm wrong. But like, you know, that's a big deal. So. What about that, like, 6-year period of time between finishing studying with this guy, mm-hmm. one of the guys, and starting a place of your own, like, right. apart from, you know, You know, I'm assuming you were still composing some, you know, sometimes in the early years of this of your recording business, but you know,
So
like, did something happen in somewhere in there where you're just
it
like, I.
did. I think the seeds for it happened earlier. They happened before I finished studying. But well, I'll say one quick thing I'll say is that, you know, I think one of the things that I found most remarkable about Babbitt was that he, more than almost any other teacher I can think of, his students sounded completely different from each other and from him. And there were a few people who were studying with him who were, you know, really into serialism or, pardon me, you know, working with arrays or, you know, doing, you know, that kind of doing the stuff that he's known for. But the vast majority of people I knew, at least in his studio, were just all over the map stylistically, and more so than any other member of that faculty. That aside, I, you know, I graduated in 2003, and I had already, it's funny, you know, going, this actually goes back to the question of like recording, doing the work I do now in collaboration. And I started on a project right as I was finishing grad school, where I wanted to make some songs myself, in the sense that I wanted to write them, record them, like perform and record them myself, and do a thing that at the time seemed kind of novel and now seems not,
Passé,
yeah.
yeah.
You know, but like my background actually, as a kid, I was a guitarist, and I grew up playing like rock and roll and blues, and I grew up in Texas, and so I was, you know, very into the kind of classic rock Texas blues kind of thing, and then somehow transitions very drastically to European modernism. But that, yeah,
they go hand in
they
hand.
have, oh, totally, man. You know, it's all about the 025 collection. But the yeah, the you know, so when I as I was getting close to graduating, I was feeling frustrated by, you know, this disconnect between being a comp being, you know, the kind of c composing I was doing and performers being on the other side of this kind of relationship in a way that felt like there wasn't. And I also was looking, you know, ahead to being like out of school and not having, you know, student composers concerts to put pieces on. And I'm like, well, maybe I should be kind of thinking about how another way to make music, being able to be more self-reliant. And so I embarked on this project, which, you know, at the outset seemed pretty innocent. And I was like, oh, you know, as a kid, I had like a multi-track machine and was kind of into recording and stuff. So, you know, maybe I'll get some more modern home recording equipment together and try to work on these songs. And so I got like, you know, this very ancient little Pro Tool system, and you know, I had a couple of okay mics. I got a couple more okay mics, and kind of like holed up in my parents' basement out on Long Island and started working on these things, on these songs. You know, some of my friends referred to them as 12-tone pop songs, which is in a sad but limited way kind of true. But anyway, so I was working on this stuff, and I found myself, A, getting more and more frustrated by the kind of lack of any collaborative element in it. You know, right, you know, it was like this very modernist idea of like, you know, the composer being the solitary figure that like makes their thing, and that's all that matters is the composer and the idea that the composer has and stuff. And it just felt like, well, this is a little bit, you know, this is so, what is the relevance of this, you know, to anybody else or to, you know. And at the same time, as I was getting more and more frustrated with the project, I also found myself getting more and more interested in the engineering side of it, you know, and like, you know, this mic sounds better than that mic. Why? You know, or this, you know, recording this thing this way sounds better than recording it that way. Why? And getting more, you know, kind of intensely invested in learning more about that stuff and trying to make better sounds. And as I was doing that, you know, I still had, you know, I was still writing some chamber music and having pieces played here and there, and I would want to get better recordings of my pieces as I was getting more interested in making better recordings of, you know, of myself. And so it was kind of like, oh, well, if I've got these okay mics, maybe I can make a slightly more okay recording of this concert of a piece of mine than the like house, you know, system would provide. And it just then it kind of started little by little to lead into, oh, if I'm going to record this group playing this piece, they asked me to then make a demo of another piece that they also had written for them. Could we do a session? And literally it was like that. And then, oh, if we're going to do that session, I should probably try to get some better equipment. And so I'd save my pennies and get some better equipment, sell the old stuff, use that to get more stuff, and just kind just of went,
snowballed.
Yeah, and it snowballed. And you know, meanwhile, throughout that 6 years, the other thing I was doing was I was working at Juilliard. I was the administrator for the composition department there.
Okay.
So I stayed really in touch with
that. Yeah, so you're still plugged
world.
In with people, and that's...
Exactly. And so, well, it, you know...
And if anything, I mean, that's kind of like having a feeder system into like, oh, you need something recorded.
Well, yeah. And so I, you know, you asked earlier about what kind of recording I was doing today. And, you know, when I really started to get very busy, you know, day to day kind of busy with gigs, like I was doing, you know, by around 2006, 2007, I had started to do a lot of work with Dan LaPelle, guitarist who runs New Focus Recordings. And then through him, I started doing more work with Ice and doing, you know, doing some album projects with people like Claire Chase and some of the people involved with Ice. And so that was great, you know, and I was just doing some amazing projects with these amazing people and trying to keep up, you know, bring the quality, you know, try to keep up with the quality of their work by match, you know, doing them justice with
right.
the quality of my work. But at the same time, you know, as I was doing these really, you know, awesome album projects, I was working at Juilliard, and, you know, just through musicians I knew, people were asking me to, like, yeah, make a audition tape for them. And so we'd go in a practice room at Juilliard with a crummy piano and a noisy room and, you know, a brass quintet rehearsing next door or whatever, and, like, you know, record some Paganini caprices or record, like, you know, Davidsbündler Tänze or something like that, you know, for just for, you know, something that you knew would never be released because the quality wasn't good enough. But given the limitations of the space and of the piano or whatever, I was trying to do my best to still make them sound good.
And you know, it's going to be, you know, it's going to be better than, you know, this kind of goes back to what you were talking about earlier with your personal frustrations of like, but it's going to sound better than them trying to do it themselves.
Well, yes. And that's another, exactly. That's another big thing that I found really quickly is that when I was trying to do the project of recording my own, writing and recording and kind of self-producing my own stuff, at least for me, I couldn't wear all those hats and be good at any one of them. Some people are amazing at doing that. Some people can self-produce, self-engineer, and self, you know, do everything themselves and make remarkable products. And that's, I mean, I have huge respect for people who can do that because it's really hard. Either you have to have a certain kind of aptitude or a certain kind of craziness or whatever. But
be able,
like,
to, well, and it, be able to basically distance yourself,
yeah,
from
exactly.
the emotion of what you're doing
exactly.
in front of the mic,
especially,
to, like, distance
yeah.
yourself behind the board.
Yeah, I think that, you know, it's like, yeah, this is kind of a whole nother conversation, especially coming from a studio owner, but, like, you know, we all know that we're in a place now where, you know, if you've got a laptop, you know, you can make recordings.
Yeah.
And you know, the equipment has gotten, relatively speaking, so good. I mean, even compared to, like, you know, a little over 10 years ago when I was working on my thing, I had this thing called the Digi 001, which was the kind of entry level Pro Tools system, and, you know, some kind of crummy preamps and whatever. And I listen back to the stuff that I made then, not often because it's, you know, I don't like to, but, you know, but it always is surprising. It's like, you know, it's not horrible. Like,
right.
it sounds way better than the stuff I made when I was a teenager with, like, a 4-track, you know, machine. So it's like, it's funny that, you know, there is the ability, you know, people have very easy access to the tools to make this stuff themselves in a way that we've had for, you know, since maybe the 1970s.
Mm.
If you were rich, you could have done it in the 1950s or 1960s, but certainly starting in, like, the late 70s into the early 80s with cassette, multi-track cassette machines, people could make their own recordings fairly easily.
Well,
but, you know, now it's just...
You can get studio quality, or what would have been made for good studio recordings in 1985, you can get for a few thousand dollars now, as opposed to the $50,000 it might have cost.
Well,
I mean,
you know, the listeners can't see that I'm looking about 10 feet away from me at a Studer A800, which I bought for a few thousand dollars used, and that machine new would be the equivalent of six figures today. So you can actually get the, and that was built in 1985. You can actually get you can get the 1985 machine for way less now, because unfortunately the resale value on this old equipment is not what it should be, but also, most people would rather not deal with an 800-pound, maintenance intensive and very inefficient system like that, when you can have something that,
fits in your pocket. Comparatively.
Exactly. And that, that for very little money has infinitely less in the way of limitations,
mm-hmm.
In terms of track count and how you can edit things and, what you can do. So, but to get back to the original point, the whole self-producing, self-recording thing, I think can be very empowering, but it can also be a bit of a wormhole and can be a difficult place to go to, because it's very easy to lose perspective, and it's very easy to lose a sense of what you're doing. I know for myself, the engineering part of it took over. I got more concerned about messing around with sounds and trying things and experimenting than I did. That, the very first things I did working on those projects were the best, because it was when I still was I had a score and I was just trying to realize what I had written in the score. But as soon as I started getting experimental, then, I would spend weeks and months on one song and it would go nowhere because I just couldn't make up my mind. And it would just, and that's one of the problems, so to speak, with the technology that's available, that, you can kind of do anything. But, I found at the same time as I was sitting in a basement, spending hours and hours and hours messing around with virtual synth sounds and stuff, then I'd go and record someone playing a Brahms sonata in a practice room. And it would be, in a weird way, so much more musically fulfilling, because it's this is just someone playing music.
Mm-hmm.
And, they pick up their instrument and they make something extraordinary, and I'm trying to capture that in a way that does it justice, and that feels like a really special and really exciting place to be, I kind of embraced that. In particular, I really embraced the kind of, I guess, the special, I don't want to say specialty, but the primary job of recording acoustic music being played.
Mm.
I haven't used a virtual synth plugin in I don't know how many years, because I just don't really do that kind of thing all that much. And I can do it, and I find it to be interesting in ways, but I find personally for me the work of setting a group of musicians or a single musician up in a room in a way that they feel like they can play what they need to play well and hear each other and see each other well and, do what they do with the technology not being in the way, but actually complementing what they do and making the most of the situation. That's very special to me and very exciting to me. It's funny. Again, not to kind of digress into a whole nother situation, but coming from as a musician, as a kid, playing in rock bands too. And I look at all the music that I grew up loving and the stuff that made me want to do any of this, most of it comes from the 50s and 60s.
Mm.
And almost all of it was recorded live in a room,
mm-hmm.
Even if I'm not talking about classical music, I'm talking about a lot of classic rock stuff,
right.
I mean, yes, there were often overdubs and there was often, maybe a lot of production involved, but at its core, there's always this foundation of, a group of people getting together in often a pretty awesome room,
mm-hmm.
and making music, as a live entity. And, I actually feel like in a weird way, it's an extraordinary thing working on jazz and classical music, because that almost is always intact,
Right.
I mean, yeah, there's certainly some new music projects where, you might be recording the click and we might be doing a lot more overdubs and kind of constructing things in a quasi pop-ish kind of way. But that's such a rarity in my world. I mean, I bring headphones out on maybe one out of 15 sessions, and you know, unless you're doing this kind of music in any other studio, that just is. I always find it funny when engineers come in from outside who don't work in this kind of music often, and they're confused by the idea that, like, they're like, well, how do you talk back to people if they're not wearing headphones? I'm like, well, you know, there's a talk back mic that goes to some speakers. I'm like, oh, like, that seems like such a novel idea that, like, you could communicate without headphones. And that's not to knock anybody. Like, I don't say that in a judgmental way. It's just like, it hits home for me how
feel.
Yeah, how it's, there's something. I feel very lucky to that this is the kind of recording I primarily do, is, you know, is essentially live performances in the studio. Yeah. Where, yeah, yes, you get a lot more takes and you do a lot more edits and you kind of chop things up. And it's not the doing.
That's like super simple. That's like, you know, really, really simplifying it. But also, I mean, you've recorded, you know, dozens of like ensemble, you know, ensembles. I mean, and like they could, if they wanted to, put a click. You could put a click in their ear and they could record. Everyone could record their part separately, like you would. For a Taylor Swift or Lana Del Rey album, like you know, those guys are not playing live in a together in a studio, and that works great for that, but in new contemporary classical music and jazz, it's so based around like the interplay between the musicians that it would, you know, you'd lose a lot. Like,
yeah, no, I absolutely. And when people come to me, I'm always, I don't want to, the thing is every project is different. I hate to kind of make generalizations
of course.
that sound like they oversimplify matters. Right. But the fact is when someone comes to me and they're like, yeah, we want to record this whole thing to click. I'm like, okay. You know,
we can do that.
Yeah, in a nice way. Why? Like, what is the reason for doing that? Like, what are you trying to achieve? Will it actually make the recording simpler and make things go more smoothly? Will it make it sound better? If so, then awesome. Let's go for it. But if it's because you think it should, or because like it, you know, I find that it's just I'm a little more defensive about like avoiding that stuff because I've been in so many situations where as soon as you introduce that kind of, I guess simply put, like in my experience, the vast majority of musicians who come from a classical background are trained to perform live.
Right.
That's the focus is concertizing. You know, you practice and you rehearse, not for a recording studio, but for a live performance. And, you know, when you introduce an element like a click track or headphones, even just, you know, isolation, you know, putting, you know, kind of, you introduce these things that are pretty foreign to the vast majority of a musician's experience of making music, you know, that's kind of a wild card. And it's a thing that isn't a, you know, part of the actual music. It's not to say that you shouldn't do it if it's appropriate, but I feel like if you're doing it because you think you should or because you want to have control,
like that's just adding an extra layer of things between you and your product. That if you know, because you're not, if it's adding in something you're not used to.
Yeah, the expression I use a lot, and talk about oversimplifying. I mean, in a very very, kind of oversimplified way, I kind of think of like the history of recording from like, I don't know, let's say 1971 through the present as just like a constant process of breaking things in order to be able to fix them. You know, like we're gonna like separate everybody into separate rooms, and yeah, they're not gonna play as well together, but we'll be able to align them, so mm-hmm. it'll be okay. Or, you know, they're not going to balance each other well because they don't hear each other well.
But we
can fix that. It's like, well, if you just had them playing together in the room, then they would probably be balanced and then you wouldn't need to fix it. Hmm. But I don't know. I mean, and again, huge oversimplification.
Right.
And it's not to say that there's not a place for really elaborate productions and when it makes sense for the, you know, artistically.
Right.
But I don't know. It's a funny kind of thing. I mean, but not to dwell on the tape machine thing, but it's just kind of sitting here staring at me. you know, when I record to tape, these days. The primary reason I do it is because, I mean, it sounds great. It's a beautiful sounding system, but it's also really limited. It's limiting. And I find that the limitations of it are good. And they're, in a weird way, it kind of makes it more like a performance, you know, especially for improvised music. When you have a group of musicians, you know, in the studio, and you say, okay, we've got 15 minutes left on this reel. Then they play like there's 15 minutes left on the reel. You know, they play like there's kind of a, there's stakes, you know, there's, it feels like there's,
well, yeah, there,
it's not an audience there. There's a sense of, okay, this is our set. Like, let's, okay, we're rolling. Let's go. This is a finite medium. You know, it's expensive. Let's be on, you know, whereas yeah, like if you're okay,
complete freedom, yeah, like you without any kind of constraints, yeah, like it can be paralyzing in a weird way because, oh, I can do anything, so exactly, I'm gonna do nothing in a risk-taking sense, let's
exactly
say.
And I think that that kind of a limitation is not only healthy, but I think it actually get in an oblique way, it brings the studio scenario a little more in line with a performance scenario, mm, because there are limitations, because there is a sense that, oh, if you make a mistake, don't just stop, you know, keep going, use it, find what you can, you know, don't dwell on the mistake, but try to stay in touch with the bigger picture of what the performance is about, mm, you know? And in, you know, the typical kind of scenario where everything is controllable in a recording studio, like, you know, it's very easy to lose sight of the big picture stuff because you know that you can fix everything, so you get obsessed with fixing everything, or you stop every time you make a mistake and you wouldn't go in and scrub it out. And but, you know, I don't know, it's like I said, it's different with every artist and every project and every piece, even, you know, mm-hmm, it just changes all the time. But that's kind of my, where I come from a little bit, I think, is that, you know, I really like the experience of being involved in. And it's funny because I don't really go to live concerts all that often.
Me neither.
I don't, for various reasons. And when I do go to live concerts, it's often because I'm recording them. So, mm-hmm, my experience of live concerts is a little bit warped. But that being said, you know, I think there's something to be said for trying to preserve, mm-hmm, a little bit of the, if not concert experience, at least the interactive, you know,
right,
human interaction that happens when people are playing music together. And even if it's a soloist, you know, it's just, you know, it's just a different kind of mentality, I think, for how you approach a recording session. And I think, yeah, a lot of that was informed by that early experience of, like, being dissatisfied with, you know, assembling music in a way in the computer and, you know, feeling like that doesn't, you know, the harder I try, the further I get from what I'm actually going for, which is the feeling of a more just, like, I hate to use this word, but organic, like, you know, musical,
yeah,
expression. Something that feels like it actually just came from you and you're saying something honest. And, you know, and it's not this, again, not to say that someone can't make that kind of a statement when they're doing it themselves on a computer with, mm-hmm, you know, it's, lots and lots of tracks. But yeah, I think you have to have a crystal clear vision of what you're going for in order for that to work. And it's very hard to have that.
Right. And then sometimes you're just not going to have that until, like, after you have sometimes decades of experience, yeah, and, yeah, recording, and you've made it enough recordings to know that, like, this is exactly what, and then maybe you can do it.
Right.
But I mean, and there are people who are younger who can do that.
Yeah, for sure.
It's certainly more rare. Mm-hmm. So
I don't really know where the question started, and I feel like I've gotten way off topic here. But
it's gone, like, off, but it's all connected. It all connects pretty well, I think. So, you know, it's, if one goes to the website of Octaven Studio,
mm-hmm,
quick aside, where does the name come from?
Oh, it's so nerdy.
Yes.
Yeah, the
you're still a contemporary composer.
I'm still a
after
contemporary
all.
Composer. Although it's not a contemporary thing. It's it's all somewhat contemporary in the more universal sense. Brahms kept this notebook throughout a lot of his professional life, that is loosely referred to as octaven and quinten, mm-hmm, or octaves and fifths. And he basically just kept a little log whenever he found an interesting example of parallel octaves or fifths in another composer's music. He would write it down and analyze it. And there, a facsimile edition of it was published by Universal Edition in the, I think in like 1920 or 1930 something. Heinrich Schenker actually edited it. And most of the examples are pretty interesting because they're often like kind of low level parallel fifths or octaves. They're not necessarily surface things. They're a little like kind of deeper voice.
Buried a little bit. Yeah.
And you know, it's super interesting, but just, I don't know, so I always, when I first saw this document, because Juilliard had a facsimile of it, I was a kind of amazed that like Brahms, to the end of his life, I mean, he kept this thing into the 1890s, you know, would take the time to be this like obsessive about craft.
Because,
you know, like,
that seems like something like a nerdy 22-year-old would do, like, oh, this is so cool.
And it's not like him being like self-righteous or anything like that. It just was like he was really invested in like, okay, if Mozart did this, obviously he had a reason for doing it. So why? Like, why is it okay here when, you know, and you know, there are examples from like Palestrina in it. You know, it's also just the book shows like that he, you know, he draws on so many different musical styles, so many different composers. So it's just this, it's a thin little sample of like what kind of, I think, one part of what Brahms was
part of like what made him tick as a person, not, you know, other besides the just the record we have of him through his music, which the way it's performed now is probably completely different than the way he would have conceived or thought of it or heard it during his life. So
you know, the kind of title, you know, octaves and fifths, or in German is Oktaven und Quinten. It stuck with me. I think I probably first saw that document when I was an undergrad, and I always just was like amazed by it. And the name Oktaven, when we were opening the studio, I had used it as a kind of placeholder for various projects over the years. And then, you know, I just kind of threw it out when Jessica and I were trying to figure out what to call the new business. And she's like, that's kind of cool. And she like mocked up a little like look for it. I was like, okay, that's kind of cool. And then it just stuck. And you know, it's, people are constantly, I kind of like that people are constantly mispronouncing it and misspelling
it.
And most recently in a number of our building, the documents around the building of the new studio, our own contractors listed it as OK Tavern. It's like, oh, we're going to open a nice little watering hole down in Mount Vernon.
Well,
OK Tavern.
Well, here's the thing. You record enough trombonists. That's basically, right. Or brass players in general, jazz, new music, like,
need to have a tap.
There's going to be a lot of drinking.
Yeah. So
saying Oktaven is just wrong.
No, I say Oktaven. It doesn't matter. I've seen Oktavian. You know, I've heard a lot of different. I think a lot of people do say Oktaven. It's completely fine. But Jessica speaks German, and I tried to speak German badly, sadly. I think the correct pronunciation is more like Oktaven. But that's the long and nerdy story behind it. Thanks to Brahms.
Well, it's a better story behind names than most people have for their groups. So like, it's usually just like, oh, I mean, we were just like, we had a list and we threw a bunch of shit around and this is what stuck. I'm like, oh, okay. No, that's a great story, guys.
Yeah, no, it actually is something that for one way or other, it's like I kind of have been in my head for a long time. You know, Johannes.
So to get back to like what I was originally going to ask you before we delved into that, because that's why I don't give people questions before I come talk to them, is because I'm just like, I'll think of something right in the middle and be like, oh
yeah,
this thing. But no, so the point is like, when you go to your website and you look, you know, there's a link for discography, of course, which makes sense because you want to see, if you're going to record somewhere, you want to see like who else has done it. It's a fairly long list that goes back to like, I don't know, 2012, 2011, something like that. And you know, there's guys that you would think, you're like, oh man, you know, Steve Reich or John Zorn, like these guys who have cast such a huge shadow, especially in the New York music world. One, and a guy like Reich, I mean, just the music world, full stop.
Yeah.
But also, you know, I have other, you know, I have friends who have smaller groups that have been together for just a few years who have come up here. You know, some friends of mine, you know, Washington Square Winds, you know, this is back 2013. You know, they were came up here to do their first album. Yeah. And, you know, now it's not even the same five people who are in the group now.
I haven't seen them since their release concert, which was like, I think, two summers ago.
So. Exactly. Yeah. You know, so it's not all the same people, but they came up here to do their first album. Mm-hmm. So, like, that's like, you know, not necessarily musically, but it's just a huge gap in experience.
Yeah.
And so.
Now, the last session at the old studio on December 31st of last year was with a high school pianist who was recording for her pre-college application tape.
Aww,
and I'm like, this is the last thing I'm doing here. And nothing wrong with it. Yeah, it's so funny. Not. It's like, you know, the first thing I did was with a group of musicians who were near and dear to me from school, but who are now doing amazing things in their career. And it's like over 7 years, it's we cover a lot of territory musically,
right.
And, you know, experience and all that. So,
so obviously you're not, you know, of course, as a business owner, and from a business owner perspective, you're not going to provide services better to one person over the other.
Yeah.
Like you're going to provide the same quality, of course, but it just from a, you know, from dealing with people who have, for better lack of a better term, a shit ton of experience,
right,
to someone who's never sat in a studio before, like how do you kind of approach that as the engineer, you know, as you're kind of like talking them through things, or
yeah,
you know, just like kind of like what's the difference? Seems like such a passe basic way to say it, but how does
that's an interesting question.
How does your job change?
That's a very interesting question. And I think probably in some ways to a fault, not a very aggressive or assertive person. And it's taken me a long time to even begin to get comfortable with being more proactive or assertive as an engineer. But one thing I'll definitely say is I try to gauge right away, even if it's someone who I know has more experience, I try to gauge right away what kind of a role they want me to take. Maybe often I don't ask, although I will ask occasionally if I'm not getting it, if I'm not totally clear. But I think it's more safe to assume if someone is coming in and they've never recorded before, or their only experiences recording before have been like their friend brought like a Zoom recorder or something like that. You know, I try to take the reins a little more, not necessarily musically, but just at least in terms of like pacing and telling them, okay, yeah, you know, we don't need to do it again. You can keep going, or I think you're covered, or you know, just like,
or do you want to take a look? Or do you want to take a look at this
again?
Word,
kind of producing.
Yeah.
And whereas if it's a much more experienced artist or composer, I mean, often they'll just, you know, from the moment they walk in the door, they make it really clear that they're running the show, and I'm happy to you know, serve that and to be.
I'll set the mics. I'll hit the button.
Well, yeah, maybe not that much, but to some extent, I mean, I've had people who want to like choose what mics they use, and who, you know, and I'm like, all right, that's. I just try to be flexible with it, but I definitely think that it's such an interesting thing. You know, at the beginning of a session, like, I try very hard for any session, and actually today might be a little bit of an exception because I'm not set up yet for my 11 o'clock session, but I try to have things as close to being set and ready to go in some fashion when people walk in the room, so they don't have to wait around for me to place things and patch things and mess around with what's going on. And I try to have the sound that comes out of the speakers be as, you know, good as possible right from moment one. But you know, that can be dangerous because if someone comes in who has a lot of experience and they know exactly what they want, you know, everyone's different, has different tastes, and I can't always predict that. And so, you know, I might kind of back myself into a corner or set up a situation where I need to change everything, and you know, you just have to roll with it, I think. Mm-hmm. I mean, I know, you know, for example, the Washington Square Winds guys were great, and they were so welcoming of my input, which I found really nice. And sometimes that's a little hard to gauge, too. Like, I think a lot of people don't expect the engineer to... If people have experience in other studios where the engineer wasn't in the classical world or didn't necessarily read a score, you know, they develop a sense that that's not their role. Right. And if I just pipe in and be like, you know, if I don't know the person well, I'm like, hey, you know, you know, that triplet in measure 47 was a little bit compressed. They'll be like, Who's this guy? Yeah, yeah. What, you know, who are you? So I'm also like, I don't want to just jump in and offer opinions and criticisms in a way that's going to seem presumptuous or or out of turn or anything like that.
It's funny when I was up here just kind of while you were working with Will. And of course, he was recording six pieces of that he had commissioned.
Yeah.
Which, and of course, he's one of the best new music performers on trombone in the country. Like, he might not say that himself, but I would, you know, people who have heard him play these pieces really think that. But I was watching, you know, he's working, you know, working really hard, and it's really, really hard music. Just one time you piped it, you just like, you turned the button on and was just like, yeah, I think that what is it? The quarter flat or quarter sharp was like a little bit low. I'm sitting back here like, did he just say that the quarter tone that he just played was too flat? Like, not because like, I Will had already told me like that you were composed, you know, you had all this experience with this stuff, but still just, you know, I don't do that kind of music hardly, like very rarely. I mean, I'm more than happy to like spend time working on that stuff.
Yeah.
Like, I'm totally into it. I love talking about it. I love the conceptual, but just like the practice of having trained myself to hear the differences between quarter tones outside of out of tune.
That specific thing is so really interesting. Like I've done a bunch of
it was just kind of I was sat back here, I was like, what?
Being very much from the like dodecaphonic tradition, you know, the whole like microtonal and not just quarter tones, but microtonal tuning is something I still feel like I'm really new to and still really learning. I've done, you know, one of my favorite groups and who I always just have a blast working with is Jack Quartet. And those guys are incredible at, you know, the precision with which they approach and are able to execute microtonal music of all different kinds. I mean, they also just, you know, their whole sense of and practice with pitch is just amazing. And so working with those guys, it's like, you know, but not just with them, with a lot of, you know, with everyone, I've felt like it's really important for them to have some basic sense that I've got their back to whatever extent that's appropriate. And what I never want them to feel like is, either they ask me like, hey, was that good? And I don't know. Or that I'm dishonest, maybe.
Right.
Like, yeah, that was great. And I have no idea. I mean, so it's like, it's this interesting kind of thing of like, A, trying to cultivate my listening skills in a way that I can actually like kind of keep up with what these, you know, performers are doing. And I often can't. Like, they're just so much more in tune. Unintended terrible pun. With what the, you know, they've worked on this music. There's so much, and that's another thing that is kind of related. But anyway, you know, I'll do my very best to hear and critique and kind of be on top of details like that. But I also, you know, will try to be very honest when I think it's beyond my capacity, and I don't want to give a false sense that something is good when I don't really know. Mm-hmm. And I feel like, you know, the only way to know is if you come and take a listen to this and make sure you're happy with it. And that's this is where one thing that I find that still is really challenging and really delicate is, you know, when someone comes in, and even, you know, it could be someone coming in and playing a Mozart sonata, it could be someone coming in and playing a piece they commissioned, could be a composer performing their own music, which happened just the other day. I had a song cycle recording where the pianist was the composer. I've worked really hard to try to develop some critical listening skills, but I'm never going to know unless I've spent a lot of time doing like pre-production work with somebody. I'm never going to know exactly what their intention is for their interpretation. You know, I'm never going to have a sense of like their ideal tempo for this movement or any of this stuff until I've learned it. And often I never have the chance to learn it because, you know, someone comes in, they play a few takes and they go away and then it gets edited. So I tend to place a lot of faith in either if a musician brings in their own producer or if they're kind of self-producing, I try to place a lot of faith in the musician that they know what they want. Mm-hmm. And it's not my job to tell them how to play a piece. You know, it's more that I'm in a supportive role that I can make sure that they're not worrying about things that they don't need to worry about.
Mm-hmm.
But that can be tricky because, you know, obviously there are, you know, people come into the studio, they get nervous, they feel like, you know, they're on the clock. And so it's not an ideal situation to be self-evaluating exactly what you're doing. Sometimes some people do it better than others, but it's tricky. You know, I'm very aware that it's easy for me to sit here in this room on one side of the glass and be like, yeah, do it again. Like, yeah, you know, that was out of tune. Do it again. Or that was, you know, that wasn't together. And at the same time, it's critical that someone kind of plays a little bit of that role. So that balance is always, it's not just that it's always a challenge, it's that it's always different with, it's an interpersonal thing. Mm-hmm. And you just have to figure out where an artist's kind of sweet spot is in terms of like how much input they want, what starts to push over the line into them feeling like you're just picking on them or, again, being presumptuous or whatever the case may be, or feeling like, you know, they actually need or want more and I'm not giving it to them. So I need to be more communicative. Like it's all this stuff is, you know, very, this stuff to me is far and away this is the job to me.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, as much as I love microphones and gear and stuff like that, that's the easy part.
Yeah, and I mean, like,
by far the easy part is getting, to me, is like getting kind of a decent sound or whatever, or like making sure like things should work, things should sound good. That to me, I just like take for granted because that's the most basic part of it.
You can read in a book where to set up, like what's the optimal distance and what mic to use for this instrument.
Yeah, and the fact is there isn't, I mean, that's a lot of that's taste. I mean, if it works and it just doesn't sound horrible, like, you know, it shouldn't be that hard to get to that point.
Yeah.
We have such amazing technology, you know, that it's, you know, yeah, I think the interpersonal part of it is much more interesting and much more challenging than anything that has to do with the actual technology or the gear or anything like that. Like, yes, there are times when it's tricky to balance something or whatever, but like that, there's always a fix for that, you know? I mean, there should be, or you're doing it wrong. Anyway, that's, you know.
Getting towards like wrapping things up. As a, you know, if we call, you know, if we're calling what you're doing, and I would definitely do that, but like the engineering and then the, like we were saying, the interpersonal relationships, all this together, you know, as an art form, you know, and the art form of recording art, I'll put it that way. How do you kind of, you know, just like with anything else, you can't stay in the same place, whether that's technical or you know, just in your skills, like just like with working, practicing trombone or writing your own music. Like, I don't think I've ever really thought about that, but you know, even once you get to where you have your own studio or you have you're booked, you have a good business,
right?
How do you kind of keep yourself moving forward in your craft and as an artist in a way? Like, how do you keep yourself moving forward and what do you do to push yourself?
I mean, the easy answer to that is just that it's always different with different projects, different musicians.
So like every single artist, like,
yeah. So I mean, it's always a new thing. And so in that very basic sense, the work is always challenging. But at the same time, I mean, other things like, I mean, this studio, this new place was a massive, you know, challenge. And, you know, there was a lot of ambition behind it, but a lot of stress and a lot of learning and a lot of wrong turns and stuff that, you know, we had to figure out as we went along. So this was a huge, huge thing. And I'm still, you know, it's a new place and I'm still learning it. I'm still trying to perfect it. You know, I'm especially the live room. I'm constantly messing around with the acoustics of it and just see if I can get it better and better. Beyond that, you know, the technology does change, and I actually just had a long conversation last night with my partner, Jessica, about the fact that I'm not running the latest version of Pro Tools, and I was trying to defend the fact that I'm not running the latest version of Pro Tools. You know, but then, you know, there is the reality that Apple is going to come out with an operating system at some point that's going to render some key thing that I use kind of no longer usable if I need to upgrade to it, and that's going to be so. There's those kinds of pain in the butt challenges that will happen. The technology will change, and there may be a sea change. You know, I mean, back to the tape machine. Like, you know, if I were an engineer in the 80s and had the switch from, you know, what I had done my whole life of like recording to analog tape, and all of a sudden learn how to use a digital editor, you know, that's like learning a new language. So if something like that comes up, that would be a whole different kind of challenge. But I mean, beyond that, like I like building gear. And so I that's a little more on the hobby side of things, but you know, I always kind of have my eye on some projects I'd like to do in terms of like either building some microphones or a bunch of the stuff that I use I built, and I'd like to keep on doing more of that to satisfy the more, you know, techie nerdy kind of part of things. But
monetize that shit.
No, yeah, it's expensive. It's an expensive hobby, sadly. Although it saves you money in terms of like not buying, you know, $10,000 vintage microphones. It still costs a lot to get good parts and put them together. But
those $10,000 vintage microphones are so cool.
No, that's the problem. You know, I can't afford them, so I build.
So and so recorded on this specific, not just this version, like this actual microphone. This actual
microphone. No, I am. You know, that's the thing. Is like, you know, it's not practical to own some of the gear that's, you know, highly desirable and sounds really wonderful, but just is, for one reason or another, not really in our world a viable tool. And so I build stuff, you know, I build kind of clones or, you know, inspired by versions of these, of, you know, either older or much more expensive things. And I really enjoy doing that. But of course, the things I build, they often then aren't perfect and I have to work on them more, so there's a that eats up a lot of time. I'd like with the new studio, and with starting to take on some staff and try to be a little more skilled at delegating the workload. I mean, I'd like to compose again at some point. You know, the last piece I wrote from the ground up was in January of 2013, and I put out a CD of my music two years ago now. Gosh, almost 2 years ago, on New Focus, and that was mostly music that was written, you know, between like 2003 and 2009. But there were a couple more recent pieces on there, and I'm long overdue. I belong to this wonderful group, Counter Induction. I'm one of the composer members of the group, but I'm the composer member who doesn't compose, so I need to rectify that situation. And
if you still want to be a member, you got to pay your dues.
I know pieces. Exactly. Basically, the group is way too nice in letting me you know, get by for long stretches of time without writing a new piece for them. So I'm due.
So when did you actually open the doors in this location? Like,
officially we're not open. This should not be broadcast, but no, I mean, because we haven't like passed our, you know, our final inspections and stuff, but unofficially our first sound check, so to speak, was our first test recording was on May 24th. It was a really insanely, for me, insanely stressful, but really fun recording with the composer Amy Williams and a bunch of like Jack and Jake Greenberg was producing it, and there's a bunch of great people involved in it. So so that, and then it's been, you know, really nonstop since then. We've already done a lot of exciting things, and we've got a lot of exciting things coming up in the next few months. But you know, we want to keep on I want to bring back the people that I've worked with, you know, for more stuff. But of course, we always like seeing new faces here and trying to just work on different things and, you know, expand the palette. You know, like I mentioned, like my background is in new music and classical music, but we've continued to do more and more jazz stuff, which I just really love. I love recording improvised music. or improvisatory music. And so that's a really, and back to your question about how do you, you know, kind of expand or grow, like that's a huge thing to me, is jumping into that side of things. Because just in terms of, you know, my whole idea of what, you know, if I'm sitting here trying to follow a session, that's so oriented around having a score in front of me. And the experience of a session becomes so different when there's not, even if there's just a chart, you know, that's one thing. But if it's like, you know, doing free improv or experimental stuff, that's largely improvised, like that's such a different kind of attention and kind of energy that's needed. And so I find that sometimes stressful, but often really fun, really challenging in great ways. So I hope that we keep on doing more of that type of thing. And just getting, you know, it's fun to get to know people in that scene that I otherwise wouldn't find, you know.
For sure. Well, Ryan, this has been great.
Oh, thank you so much.
This is, I feel good. Feel good about it.
My pleasure. Me too.
Thanks.
Thank you.